evidentiary balancing test. The court held that warrantless entry was unlawful. However, the kind of warrant that would be required based upon a balancing test that the Supreme Court imposed would require not individualized suspicion, but only a determination of reasonableness by a court for area searches. In other words, in order to make sure that houses, dwellings, particularly in San Francisco, which having lived there for some 4 summers in a row, in the middle of the older sections of San Francisco, the houses there tend to be very old and susceptible to conditions that are unsafe, presenting fire hazards, among other things. There's always fires. And so the court took that into consideration in terms of the compelling or at least significant governmental interest in ensuring safety for areas within the city. And therefore, suspended the requirement of individualized suspicion. In other words, the housing authority could say, well, here's a block, a city block, or an area within the city that we haven't inspected for 10, 15, 20 years. We have no reason to suspect that any particular dwelling within the area requires our inspection, or any particular dwelling poses a threat, but an inspection would be necessary to ensure consistency in determining safety. So the court departed from the particularized suspicion requirements of probable cause in that sense in the Camara case. And a companion case was city fire inspectors acting pursuant to a city ordinance authorizing entry into non-dwellings, businesses, to inspect for fire code violations, demanded entry into a warehouse without a warrant. Here, too, the owner refused entry and was prosecuted criminally for the refusal, and consistent with the decision in the companion case of Camara, the city lost, and again, the Supreme Court held that this very different kind of showing would satisfy Fourth Amendment requirements, non-particularized suspicion, area searches, administrative searches, if you will. And this was C versus City of Seattle. With those two cases as a backdrop, along comes the scenario that we now take a closer look at. A police officer with some 40-plus years of experience is patrolling on foot in downtown Cleveland on one wintry day, or at least it was a cold enough day for the perps that he observed to be wearing overcoats. But it's in daylight hours, beautiful downtown Cleveland. I'll cast no further aspersions on Cleveland. When he notices 3 men acting very suspiciously, they're walking up and down, seemingly casing a store in preparation for a daytime robbery. He approaches one of the men and actually says to the 3 of them, "Tell me your names," or "What are your names?" And when they mumbled something inaudible, he put his hands on Terry, flipped him around, and frisked him, his outer clothing, feeling what he believed to be a weapon. And he pulled off his jacket as he pushed them into the store and removed from Terry's coat, a gun. The other two men, Chilton and Katz, were also apprehended, but I don't believe there was a weapon on either of the other two. In any event, Terry was charged with possession of a concealed weapon. And, of course, the question that was posed in Terry versus Ohio was whether what the officer did was unlawful because there was no probable cause and no warrant. So one of the first questions we have to pursue is, what is the difference between what Officer McFadden had in Terry versus Ohio and the traditional probable cause that we have been studying that would ordinarily be required by the Fourth Amendment? Anybody have any idea? I'll ask that. Amarina? What's that? That's not my question. If you say it's a reasonable suspicion, you've already answered all the things that I wanted to explore. What is the traditional requirement for police action in this setting before Terry versus Ohio? Needed to get a warrant before doing what the officer did here? A lawful arrest for a commission of a crime. Were they just walking? So, if the officer were acting under the traditional tests before Terry, what would the officer have to be possessed of in his mind as he observed those three men? Probable cause for... Well, probable cause that they were armed and dangerous is what results from Terry. What's the traditional test? Anthony, you're back. Probable cause to believe that the person before him has committed a crime?
Or maybe will?
Will? Is will within the purview of the traditional test?
I think it's just has
or is then and there committing. That's the traditional definition of probable cause. Go back to the introduction to the probable cause section of the case book and you'll see that which gives a person in a position of a police officer reasonable grounds to believe or suspect to a certain degree of probability, which we end up learning after Gates is a fair probability, that the person before the officer has committed or is then and there committing an offense. And after Atwater, it could be any offense to be subject to arrest. Or for a search that a person or object that is seizable will be found in the place to be searched. So the Supreme Court in Terry concluded that the scenario facing Officer McFadden wouldn't justify his seizure of the suspects or the search of Terry to reveal the weapon. Now, I have always suspected and believed that the court reached out pursuant to a plan by Chief Justice Warren to create the stop and frisk standard that later became known as reasonable suspicion. Because look at the scenario. under the traditional probable cause test, could Officer McFadden have acted under probable cause standards? You say no. I say take a look at it again and stretch your minds. John?
I mean, I think there is
probable cause for?
For a search procedure.
For? The test is reasonable grounds to believe by a certain quantum of evidence that?
That a crime has taken, is or has taken place. Or
yes.
Or weapons that.
Okay, so how could the officer, how could Officer McFadden have concluded that in this scenario? That what? What crime?
Well, if they're casing the joint,
what crime is that? Very simply, tell me what crime that constitutes that the officer could conclude by a fair probability that they have committed or are committing an offense.
Conspiracy.
I've always thought that this was a great conspiracy scenario. Anything else? It isn't robbery, because it hasn't happened yet. What?
Well, if he thinks that they have weapons on them, then they could have weapons illegally.
Okay. Is it grounds to have probable cause to believe that they're carrying a concealed weapon unlawfully? That's possible.
Well, I mean, it seems like the police officer would be in a better position to know that than some people on the bench.
Well, true, but that's not the issue. The issue is formulating the propositions under the test that existed, what crime or crimes could the officer believe they were committing or had committed? Conspiracy is one that they probably already committed when they were all 24 times standing there yakking at each other, planning it out. You're the second person to say that. That's what someone said in the other class, too. Loitering isn't a sufficient enough serious crime to justify a seizure and a search. Certainly, prior to Atwater, I don't even think the officer could arrest for loitering, right? Nothing else come to mind? You have to dig deep into your criminal law background. You remember the cases of the guy smoking a pipe next to a haystack? No? Who'd you have for criminal law? I'm sure he taught this. This is one of his favorite subjects. What?
Pugsley.
Pugsley, I know he loves it. I team taught criminal law with him 30 years ago. Attempt. Didn't what they were doing amount to an attempted robbery? On the other hand, maybe, I mean, if you were a prosecutor, and we could suspend everything, and Officer McFadden came running into your office and said, here's what's going on, can I arrest them, and will you prosecute for conspiracy, possession of a weapon, or attempt robbery? I mean, is it likely you would do so based on these facts? I don't know. It would be a tough case. Well, what is different about what the court approved in Terry versus Ohio? It is that it authorized a police intervention into an ongoing street scene scenario where the officer suspected that criminal conduct was about to take place. Criminal conduct afoot is the way the court characterized it. That would justify the stop, which is a seizure for Fourth Amendment purposes, but a lesser S seizure than a full-blown arrest of the person or apprehension of them physically, certainly a lot less than a custodial arrest. But still, nonetheless, the court spends a lot of time in the decision making it clear that the intrusion of a stop is a substantial interference under the Fourth Amendment. And the other part of it is, what justifies the frisk or the small S search? And that is reasonable grounds to suspect that the person is armed and dangerous. So stop and frisk is the subject matter of the Terry case, authorization of which is when an officer has some certain quantum of belief or suspicion that a person is about to commit a crime, that criminal conduct is afoot, and that the individual is armed and dangerous, the officer may stop that person and frisk him. So, on this PowerPoint slide, I say, what could the officer have done prior to Terry? And the answer is probably nothing. He would have to wait for something further to take place, or maybe never be able to interfere until afterwards, which would be a shame. But the court specifically wanted to approve the stop and frisk conduct under the rubric of what later became to be known as reasonable suspicion. You'll notice that that term never appears in Terry. It's not until some time later that the court looks back on it and refers to it as reasonable suspicion. And of course, the theory is predicated upon the Camara and C cases, that there is a government interest on one side of the balance that when measured against the protected individual interest gives rise to allowing the government conduct on less than the Fourth Amendment traditional warrant and probable cause requirements. In contrast, the next one is a police officer watches the defendant converse with known narcotics addicts for 8 hours. When the defendant entered a restaurant and ordered pie and coffee, a very significant aspect of this scenario, the pie and coffee, the police officer told the defendant to come outside. The pie and coffee is what always triggers my memory of this case, which is why I always put it in. When the officer got the guy outside, he said to the defendant, "You know what I'm after." And then the defendant mumbled something, reached in his pocket. The police officer, without more, thrust his hand in the pocket and extracted packets of heroin. Was this a valid stop and frisk under Terry? No. This is the companion case of Sibrin versus New York. What's different about this scenario from Terry? This is no grounds to believe, number one, that criminal conduct was afoot. Criminal activity was afoot. The officer may have suspected that the defendant had previously engaged in some sort of drug transaction, but he had really no grounds to know or suspect that there was anything that was going on then and there, and there was no basis for a belief that the suspect was armed and dangerous. Certainly not enough to justify the full-blown search of reaching into his pocket without more. So, couple of things that Sibron points out in contrast with Terry itself. What is it that an officer can do in terms of the stop? Can there be a seizure of an individual for investigative purposes, absent a suspicion that the suspect is armed and dangerous? In other words, is armed and dangerous a necessary component of the Terry formulation? Well, the court expresses some information about that in footnote 16 on page 324. We thus decide nothing today concerning the constitutional propriety of an investigative seizure upon less than probable cause for purposes of detention and/or interrogation. Obviously, not all personal intercourse between policemen and citizens involves seizures of persons. And then, very significantly, the court defines what constitutes a seizure. But the main point I was addressing by reference to this footnote first was the point that after Terry, and until sometime thereafter, what Terry seemed to authorize was only a stop and frisk, and only when the suspect was believed to be armed and dangerous, not an independently justified stop for investigative detention. That, of course, changes, and by the time of Mendenhall, it's a dead letter. But then, another question is, what constitutes a seizure for Fourth Amendment purposes, even under Terry? A seizure as minimally intrusive as a stop for investigative purposes. And again, the court makes clear that that's a Fourth Amendment intrusion and is not that minimal. But here's the definition, and it ought to clang a bell in your head. Again, looking at footnote 16, only when the officer, by means of physical force or show of authority, has in some way restrained the liberty of a citizen, may we conclude that a seizure has occurred. So, and then, of course, the court points out that the actual time of the seizure was for sure when Officer McFadden laid his hands on Terry and frisked him and stopped him prior to the frisk. Next, another question that arises, and certainly in contrast with the facts of Cibron, what kind of search is justified? By the circumstances authorized in Terry. The answer appears right after the reference to Cibron on page 327 in the majority decision. The sole justification of the search in the present situation is the protection of the police officer and others nearby, as Emily made reference to earlier, and it must therefore be confined in scope to an intrusion reasonably designed to discover guns, knives, clubs, or other hidden instruments for the assault of the police officer. So the frisk is minimal in the sense that the officer can only touch the outer clothing and only to sense such objects as serious weaponry. So that's what Terry authorizes. Before we go on, one of the things that we need to stop and mention, at least, is what is the balancing test generated by Terry and Camara and C? Well, it isn't a test that is, it isn't balancing that is done by you, unless you become a member of the judiciary, and maybe even only a member of the Supreme Court of the United States, which is certainly possible. But you, as lawyers and certainly law students, do not do the balancing. So if you come to an area, a topic within the realm of what hasn't been decided yet, perhaps you might say, well, I have a scenario here that isn't covered by any of the cases or any of the categories, and so I have to surmise whether a court would find that balancing would apply here to yield the application of a Terry test. But certainly it is a test done by the court. And now, with the history of time and precedent There are a number of things we can say about what Terry's test covers. It is that a test whereby the court balances the nature and extent of the intrusion affected by a search or seizure upon individual interests in privacy and liberty against the nature and importance of the governmental interests served by the search or seizure. The ultimate test is reasonableness. And one of the things we might say is that the Terry balancing test is a huge super exception to the warrant requirement, and certainly probable cause as well. Ultimately, the test is whether the conduct is reasonable, and certainly you see that justices like Justice Scalia can view the Fourth Amendment issue in terms of ultimate reasonableness, rejecting to some degree, if not entirely, the per se rule based upon this development of judicial thinking. And of course, the provision of the Fourth Amendment that leads to this balancing is the reasonableness language of the Fourth Amendment. So, it is surely an exception to both probable cause and the warrant requirements. It's different from the few well-articulated exceptions referred to in reference to the per se rule. And I'm going to then give you a list of the categories that have been approved. It is significant to point out that this list reinforces a position taken by Justice White concurring in the Dunaway case, where he suggests that categories are the basic approach, categorical determinations. So here are the categories that have been approved by the court: stops and frisks, frisks of cars and drivers, frisks of houses, detentions for questioning by police officers without requiring a showing of belief that the suspect is armed and dangerous, border entries. One might argue that border searches are sui generis and are separate and apart from Terry considerations. On the other hand, one could also say that border searches are a recognition of the ultimate governmental interest, protecting the borders of the country. Children in school, drug couriers and traffickers, we have a lot more to say about that in tonight's class. Public employees in the workplace, operators of public transportation mechanisms, trains, planes, public transport. These last two plus children in school could be viewed also as the compelling state interest cases, the special needs cases, so-called, where the court has consistently stripped away particularized suspicion as well as probable cause and a warrant. For example, drug testing of employees engaged in governmental activities that are significant or important, those where public health, safety, and welfare are concerned. Such drug testing has been upheld on this special needs consideration where there need not even be any particularized showing. Children in school, certain cases have upheld drug testing of children in school, but most of the cases have required that there at least be some showing of a need, even though particularized suspicion is not necessary. And we will study those cases and those topics. Okay. So that's the first one. Terry, anybody have any questions about what we've covered so far? Okay. So next is this lead-in to Dunaway, called Dunaway Detentions and Seizures of Persons. We lead into it with, I guess this is Dunaway itself. Police go to a home to find a suspect for whom they have at most reasonable suspicion that he perpetrated an attempted robbery that resulted in death. They have reason to suspect that he's at a friend's home, so they go there. And when they knock at the door, the defendant himself answers the door. The police officers, quote, ask him, close quote, to go to the station with them for questioning. He agrees, goes along, and after an hour of interrogation, makes incriminating statements. Is the evidence of the statements admissible or inadmissible as having been fruit of a Fourth Amendment violation? And this is the Dunaway case. How could there be any argument that what took place here is within the realm of Terry versus Ohio? I mean, it seems suspicious. But at this time, the court had not limited Terry, and so the government argument was that merely detaining someone to interrogate them, even for as much as an hour and even at a police station, was not a sufficiently significant further Fourth Amendment intrusion than what took place out on the street in Terry. And of course, the court rejected that. The dissent argued that the defendant had consented to go to the police station and argued that the case should have turned on that. Again, the Rehnquist morning after regrets notion that his claim that he didn't consent was the product of morning after regret. But a very idealistic Justice Brennan wrote a majority opinion that concluded that taking the defendant to the police station for interrogation, removing him from a place that he had a right to be, to take him for detention of an hour's duration before he gave it up, and questioning him was beyond the scope of what Terry was meant to be. And according to the majority, Terry was a unique, very limited scenario that should not be deviated from. And if you look at Justice White's concurring opinion, this very small excerpt from it, he says, the opinion of the court might be read to indicate that Terry is an almost unique exception to a hard and fast standard of probable cause. As our prior cases hold, however, the key principle of the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness, the balancing of competing interests. But if courts and law enforcement officials are to have workable rules, this balancing must in large part be done, oh, here's where he said the categorical, on a categorical basis, not in an ad hoc case-by-case fashion by individual police officers. So this is where he first advocated the categorical determination. On the other hand, the need for rules of general applicability precludes neither the recognition in particular cases of extraordinary private or public interest nor the generic recognition of certain exceptions to the normal rule of probable cause where more flexibility is essential. It is enough for me that the police conduct here is similar enough to an arrest that the normal level of probable cause is necessary before the interests of privacy and personal security must give way. So what is there about this, one must ask, the scenario in Dunaway that makes it more like an arrest? And the two factors significantly are removing the person from where they have a right to be and detaining for such an extensive period of time, as well as interrogation. Police officers, in this next hypothetical, pull over a motorist in a car with an expired license plate. The police officer orders the driver to get out of the car. Police officer notices a bulge in the driver's jacket. The police officer frisks the driver and finds a weapon. Can the weapon be introduced at a later trial for illegal possession of a gun? What is the conduct or activity of the police that even raises a question? It is ordering the suspect from the vehicle. One would, on the one hand, say that this is beyond the scope of Terry versus Ohio because it is more than a stop. The stop of the vehicle constitutes the stop. The imposition of the police authority to order the suspect from the vehicle is a further intrusion, and the question is it great enough to break it free from the Terry principles? And the court in this case found that the governmental interest of protection of the police from the widespread violence that occurs when there are vehicle stops justifies the minimal intrusion of ordering the suspect or the driver out of the car. So this is Pennsylvania versus Mims, which is cited in Dunaway as an example. Page 332, because Terry involved an exception to the general rule requiring probable cause, this court has been careful to maintain its narrow scope. Terry itself involved a limited on-the-street frisk for weapons, and two subsequent cases also involved limited weapons frisks. The first is my favorite, Adams versus Williams, which I didn't repeat in here, but to refresh your recollection of it, that's the case where an officer is approached by a known informant out on the street who says, there's a guy around the corner sitting in a car with a gun at his waist. The officer goes around the corner. There's a guy sitting there. The officer knocks on the window and tells him to get out of the car. Instead, he rolls the window down. The officer reaches in, pulls out a gun. That was Adams versus Williams, and the court found that that was a minimal intrusion justified for protective purposes given what was only reasonable suspicion, not probable cause. And that decision, written by then Justice Rehnquist, cited Terry and found that it was reasonable suspicion. And then, of course, the court also refers to Mims. Police officers observe nervous airline passenger about to board a plane from Miami to New York. They know that he's bought a one-way ticket with cash, and he fits drug courier profile. The police officers approach the suspect, get his airline ticket and driver's license from him, and take his luggage. They then remove him to a small room, police holding room, 40 feet away to question him further. The police officers open the defendant's luggage, finding marijuana. Does the seizure of the marijuana violate the Fourth Amendment? Well, that, of course, depends upon whether the stop and further conduct by the officers was valid. And the argument was whether this was permissible police conduct under the principles of Terry. This is Florida versus Royer. The first time we encounter it, there are two or three other places in today's class that we will talk about it. But this was only a plurality decision, but the holding in the case was that at the very least, the movement of the officer by the officers of the suspect to the police room required probable cause, not just reasonable suspicion, and that they didn't have it at that point. But at our point now, this 1983 decision, we can't really answer the question of whether the detention up to the point of removal to the police room constituted a detention in excess of what was approved in Terry and Dunaway. And the court was split on that. Okay. We move from these, and by the way, Dunaway is the road not taken by the Supreme Court. The very narrow reading of Terry that seems to be endorsed by the majority through Brennan's decision, the court never looked back again. Because, as you must know now, much police conduct has been authorized under Terry principles, going far beyond what Justice Brennan would have envisioned Terry to encompass. So, DEA agents see the defendant acting like a drug courier, fitting a drug courier profile, in the Detroit airport, another favorite Midwest city. And I shudder to think what Detroit's going to do to the Bears next weekend. So she arrives from LA, a source city, according to drug courier profiling. She's the last to leave the plane, a significant fact according to drug courier profiling. She appears very nervous. She scans the entire area of the boarding area. And she goes past the baggage claim area because she's going to a connecting flight in which she's changing airlines to leave Detroit. Now, all of this is highly questionable as valid suspicion grounds, because much of it would apply to a majority or some large number of airline travelers. Nonetheless, these are characteristics that have been marked by the police, by those who are in law enforcement with experience, as indicative of drug couriers, as well as innocent conduct. So the question that's posed initially is this enough reasonable suspicion to detain and investigate the defendant? And this, of course, is Mendenhall. And if you think that Mendenhall provides an answer to this first question, you're mistaken. Because the court split very significantly and very complexly. I always have to write down what the court did here. First, there was a question of whether there was reasonable suspicion. I mean, that's the first question I've raised, not the first the court dealt with. Three justices found there was reasonable suspicion. Four implied that if there was reasonable suspicion, the stop was okay. But certainly no majority found that this added up to reasonable suspicion. Actually, on the question of whether the stop was justified initially, three said there was reasonable suspicion and four said there was no reasonable suspicion. But more significant, or equally significantly, there was a question of whether there was a seizure by them stopping her and questioning her, detaining and questioning her. This is before she was taken away to the interrogation room. Two justices said no, and that, of course, was the majority, quote-unquote, authors, Stewart and then-Justice Rehnquist. Three said yes without deciding. Four said yes, there should be. Four said it should be decided by the trial court, which had not decided it. So, there wasn't even a majority view of whether she was seized in that initial encounter. And, of course, the case was ultimately resolved on the basis of her consenting to the removal to the interrogation or the police room, DEA room, where she was given a strip search to which she was found to have consented also. Wouldn't everybody? So, the one thing that the court did decide will come to momentarily. In this scenario, the agents identify themselves, ask questions revealing the defendant is traveling on a false name. They obtain her ticket and driver's license and, quote, ask her to accompany them to their nearby offices. And on this question, of course, was there a seizure? And in answer to this, the court included in the majority opinion, the so-called majority opinion, a test to determine whether there is a seizure. And that test is set forth on page 336. Person is seized only when by means of physical force or a show of authority his freedom of movement is restrained. Now you may recall that we were looking in Terry itself on page 324 footnote 16 the definition of a seizure only when a person or an officer only when the officer, by means of physical force or show of authority, has in some way restrained the liberty of a citizen, may we conclude that a seizure has occurred. So, this is building upon what Terry began in terms of the test of when there's a seizure. In other words, this part of the test Mendenhall did not initiate, but picked up from Terry. But then it's enhanced. On the next page, 337, a person has been seized only if, in view of all the circumstances surrounding the incident, a reasonable person would have believed that he was not free to leave. And then that further enhancement is supported by a footnote. Same page, footnote 6. The subjective intention of the law enforcement officer is irrelevant except insofar as that may have been communicated to the suspect. The bottom line is the Mendenhall test for when there is a seizure is the objectively determined point of view of the putative arrestee, whether they feel restrained, i.e. free to leave. And the intent of the officer not to let them go is only taken into account if it is somehow communicated to the person. So, whatever else you need to gain from Mendenhall, it is certainly this test. Then, of course, in Mendenhall, the officers returned her ticket and driver's license to her, and then she went to the DEA offices 50 feet up the stairway and ultimately agreed to a strip search revealing a packet of heroin, which she very nicely turned over to the agent who was administering the strip search. The validity of the search could only be upheld in this case on the basis of the consent that the court found to have been given, because certainly everything else about this was far in excess of what would be allowed under the Terry principles. And as I pointed out at the beginning of this discussion, no majority of the court found that there was grounds for her search. Of course, one of the things that you have to note is that none of the justices talked about a search being not justified because there was no reason to believe she was armed and dangerous. She'd just gotten off an airplane. There was no reason to think she was carrying a weapon. Although they suspected her of being a drug courier, the circumstances were such that there was no reason to believe that she was armed and dangerous. So if enough justices believed that this police conduct, this governmental conduct, was reasonable under Fourth Amendment standards under Terry, it must be that an investigation, a detention for investigation, can be or could be at the time of Mendenhall, which was 1980, approved under Terry principles, so that Terry principles had been cut loose from the armed and dangerous aspect, and that the footnote in Terry that said, "We decide nothing today concerning the constitutional propriety of an investigative seizure for a seizure for investigation, absent armed and dangerous," the court had already sub silentio approved that. Okay. Anybody have any questions about Mendenhall? Because now the waters get muddied. post-Mendenhall threshold seizure questions. Police officers approach the defendant in an airport concourse, ask for and examine his ticket and driver's license. Did this constitute a seizure of the defendant? Well, Mendenhall did not answer that question because none of the justices, not a majority of the justices, concluded there was a seizure at that point. And this is our second go at Royer. Page 343, note A, after the decision in Mendenhall, the court addressed this situation in Royer. A plurality of the court concluded that no seizure occurred at this point. But that was only a plurality. So, merely taking his ticket and driver's license, because they ultimately gave it back to him, would not constitute a sufficient intrusion to equal a seizure. And he could ask for this back and turn and walk away. But when they took him to the interrogation room, the police room, he was seized. Because they did retain his driver's license and ticket and did not indicate that he was free to leave. So Royer post-Mendenhall added a little bit. But it's certainly consistent with Dunaway itself, the carting him off to the police room. And there was no question of consent in Royer as there had been in Mendenhall. So then we come to defendant standing on a corner, and he sees the police approaching in a police marked police cruiser, and he turns and runs. The police car went after him, catching up and driving alongside him for a short distance. There was no show of authority, no yelling out, halt in the name of the law, or anything like that. And while the guy's running, he jettisons a pack of pills, which the police seized and offer against him at trial. This was no seizure, according to the court in 1988 in Michigan versus Chesternut. There was no conduct by law enforcement that constituted a seizure of the person under the Mendenhall test. And as I think we'll see in a minute, also consistent with other tests. Next is INS agents randomly visit a factory to question workers to determine whether any are illegal aliens. Several agents stand near the building's exits, and other agents walk through the factory questioning workers. Does this government conduct constitute a seizure of the workers? Actually, some of the workers were walking around and some actually left, which would suggest the ultimate answer, which is this did not constitute a seizure And this was the INS versus Delgado case discussed in Bostick. The court found that there was no seizure in INS versus Delgado under these circumstances. And that was relied upon in the bus interdiction case. Police officers clearly identifiable as officers board an interstate bus as part of a drug interdiction program. With a gun in the pouch, with a gun in a pouch, in the hand of one of the officers, clearly identifiable as a gun in a pouch, but not drawn. The court likens it to the gun being in a holster. The officer approaches the defendant with no suspicion and inspects the ticket and identification, returns them to the defendant, and asks for consent to search the defendant's bag. And once again, the question of whether there was consent as a factual matter is ultimately disputed, but the trial court concluded that, actually the trial court did not decide the issue. Of consent, because the lower courts generated a per se rule in this case that the conduct of law enforcement constituted a seizure, which the Supreme Court ultimately struck down. So the question that was presented was whether the cocaine that was discovered after the consensual quote-unquote search was the result of an invalid Fourth Amendment intrusion by the police conduct investigating the suspect before consent was given. So the Bostick court held that the Florida court's per se rule was improper and based on an improper test from Mendenhall. The Mendenhall test would be whether a person in the position of the defendant in Bostick would feel free to leave. But the court changed that test. So if you look on page 346, the court reviews the Delgado case, and then in the third full paragraph, the present case is analytically indistinguishable from Delgado. Like the workers in that case, Bostick's freedom of movement was restricted by a factor independent of police conduct. That is, by his being a passenger on a bus. Accordingly, the free-to-leave analysis on which the defendant relies is inapplicable. In such a situation, the appropriate inquiry is whether a reasonable person would feel free to decline the officer's requests or otherwise terminate the encounter. So when dealing with suspects who are in a position, such as in a workplace, or on buses, trains, planes, and the like, where their confinement is due to their own choice, the test is not whether they would feel free to leave when confronted by a police officer or by law enforcement, but whether a reasonable person in their position would feel free to decline the officer's requests or otherwise terminate the encounter. So, the court remanded the case for a determination whether the circumstances justified the application of the new test to result in a different finding. As the court said, the facts of this case as described by the Florida Supreme Court leave some doubt whether a seizure occurred. Nevertheless, we refrain from deciding whether or not a seizure occurred in this case. The trial court made no express finding of fact, and the Florida Supreme Court rested its decision on a single fact that the encounter took place on a bus rather than the totality of the circumstances. We remand so that the Florida courts may evaluate the seizure question under the current legal standard. Questions? Okay. So how does the Mendenhall test change after Bostick? Again, here's the language. In situations like Delgado and Bostick, the appropriate inquiry is whether a reasonable person will feel free to decline the officer's requests or otherwise terminate the encounter, rather than feel free to leave. So far we have the Mendenhall test, feel free to leave, and this test.
So the Mendenhall test still applies, but just not in situations like you're on a bus or on a plane and you're choosing to
leave. Exactly. Mendenhall is still a test that is applicable in general to determine whether a seizure has occurred. It's modified when the scenario is one where a person has been confined in a workplace like Delgado, or on a bus or other confined space because they're traveling. Trains, planes, and buses. And that leads to the next bus case, which is Drayton. The difference in Drayton: police officers boarded a bus to conduct a routine drug interdiction. One police officer knelt by a driver facing passengers, while two others went down the aisle approaching passengers ominously. They came to the defendants and asked to search their bag, which they did and found nothing. Then one officer said, "Do you mind if I check your person?" The defendant says yes, and a frisk ensues during which the police officer feels hard objects like drug packages, leading to the arrest, further search, and discovery of plastic bundles of cocaine. Was there a seizure of the defendant prior to the consent frisk? The court held, under the principles of Bostick, that there was no seizure. The 11th Circuit had overturned a trial court's denial of the motion to suppress. Case went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court reversed, holding that Drayton and his fellow companion were not seized, and their consent to the searches was voluntary. (Clears throat) I'm looking at page 352 in the description of Drayton. The court held the 11th Circuit had erred by relying upon the failure of the officer in Drayton to advise the suspect of the right to refuse to consent. And that had not been present in Bostick, so the court found that that was an error of the 11th Circuit. In other words, although in Bostick the suspect had been informed of the right to refuse consent, it wasn't an essential ingredient to the decision. There really wasn't a decision on the validity of the consent. According to the court, second paragraph, page 352, no seizure had occurred in Drayton because the officers gave the passengers no reason to believe that they were required to answer the officer's questions. The questioning officer did not brandish a weapon, spoke to passengers one by one and in a polite, quiet voice, and said nothing that would suggest to a reasonable person that he or she was barred from leaving the bus or otherwise terminating the encounter. So, Drayton really is a substantial approval of Bostick's principles in a case where the court specifically found that the scenario was no seizure and a consent to search. And then finally, this is right. Finally, police officers patrolling in an unmarked car but in jackets marked police on the back, approached four or five youths near a parked car. When the youth saw the police officers, they fled, and one police officer pursued the defendant on foot, chasing after him. And just as in Michigan versus Chesternut, the suspect jettisoned a small rock, which turned out to be crack cocaine. The officer finally caught up with the defendant, tackled him, and retrieved the rock. So the question was the defendant seized before he tossed the rock away? And this, of course, is Hodari D., in which the Supreme Court held that there was no seizure by the mere chasing of the suspect by the officer. A significant aspect of this case was that the state, California, had conceded that there was no reasonable suspicion at the point in time when the officer chased the fleeing suspect. And in a poignant footnote, Justice Scalia suggested that that might have been a mistake by California because footnote 1, page 353, that it would be unreasonable to stop for brief inquiry young men who scatter in panic upon the mere sighting of the police is not self-evident and arguably contradicts proverbial common sense. Citing the Bible, the wicked flee when no man pursueth. We do not decide that point here, but rely entirely on the state's concession. But secondly, and very importantly, the court once again redefined the Mendenhall seizure test. looking at page 354, very significant language. Second to last paragraph, towards the bottom of the paragraph. Hodari was untouched by Officer Petroso at the time he discarded the cocaine. His defense relies instead upon the proposition that a seizure occurs when the officer, by means of physical force or show of authority, emphasized or show of authority, has in some way restrained the liberty of a citizen, citing Terry. And of course, you could cite Hodari D as well. Hodari contends, and we accept as true for purposes of this decision, that Petroso's pursuit qualified as a show of authority, calling upon Hodari to halt. The narrow question before us is whether, with respect to a show of authority as with respect to the application of physical force, a seizure occurs even though the subject does not yield. We hold it does not. The language of the Fourth Amendment, of course, cannot sustain respondents' contention, of course. The word seizure readily bears the meaning of a laying on of hands or application of physical force to restrain movement even when it is ultimately unsuccessful. She seized the purse of the snatcher, but he broke out of her grasp. She seized the purse snatcher, but he broke out of her grasp. It does not remotely apply, however, to the prospect of a policeman yelling, "Stop in the name of the law," at a fleeing form that continues to flee. That is no seizure. Nor can the result respondent wishes to achieve be produced indirectly, as it were, by suggesting that Petroso's uncomplied with show of authority was a common law arrest, and then appealing to the principle that all common law arrests are seizures. An arrest requires either physical force, or, where that is absent, submission to the assertion of authority. So, other significant language, next page, 355, middle of the first paragraph. A person has been seized within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment only if, in view of all the circumstances surrounding the incident, a reasonable person would have believed that he was not free to leave. That's the Mendenhall test. In seeking to rely on that test here, respondent fails to read it carefully. It says when a person has been seized, that a person has been seized only if, not that he has been seized whenever. It is a necessary but not a sufficient condition for seizure, or more precisely, for seizure affected by a show of authority. Mendenhall establishes that the test for existence of a show of authority is an objective one, not whether the citizen perceived he was being ordered to restrict his movement, but whether the officer's words and actions would have conveyed that to a reasonable person. Application of this objective test was the basis for our decision in the other case principally relied upon, Chesternut, where we concluded that the police cruiser's slow following of the defendant did not convey that message, that he was not free to disregard the officer and the police and go about his business. We did not address in Chesternut, however, the question whether if the Mendenhall test was met, if the message that the defendant was not free to leave had been conveyed, a Fourth Amendment seizure would have occurred. In sum, assuming that Petroso's pursuit in the present case constituted a show of authority enjoining Hodari to halt, since Hodari did not comply, he was not seized until he was tackled, and hence the throwing off of the rock was an act that preceded any seizure, and there was no Fourth Amendment violation. Police officers stopped a car to verify the validity of its temporary permit. The defendant was in the car. One thing led to another, and the defendant was found to have drugs in his possession. Did the stop of the car constitute its Fourth Amendment seizure of defendant as a passenger. In other words, is a passenger in a motor vehicle seized when the vehicle is stopped by the police? And I say to that, duh, yeah, that's Brendlin. Discussed in note 4 on page 359. There was one other thing that we probably could spend a long time talking about, but I'll just refer you to it. Before that, Arda? Yes. It changed the Mendenhall test's applicability to a test of whether there's a seizure when there is only a show of authority and not the application of physical force. Under Hodari D, Mendenhall does not answer. Mendenhall alone does not answer whether there's a seizure when there's a mere show of authority. So if a police officer says, halt in the name of the law, and the suspect continues fleeing, there is no seizure because there's been no submission to the show of authority. So you've got two scenarios, show of authority or application of physical force. Application of physical force completes the seizure, even if the suspect breaks away and escapes. And that's kind of an anomaly under this redefined test, but Scalia is willing to live with that anomaly. In other words, an officer who's touched someone could be standing there yelling, halt in the name of the law, suspect flees, but there has been a seizure. But when there's a mere show of authority, no suspect is seized unless and until the suspect submits. And your question leads me to the last thing I wanted to talk about in connection with this, which is one of the problems assigned in the hypotheticals. Find which one it is. I thought I had my hands on it. Okay, it's 5A5. The facts are, and an officer was patrolling an area of the city in a marked cruiser, wearing a uniform and a badge. There had been a recent string of burglaries in the area. While driving east, he saw a man and a woman walking toward him. It was a very warm night, yet both wore heavy jackets. The man carried a gym-type duffel bag. The officer had recently arrested the woman, so he recognized her, on larceny and burglary charges. He had a mere hunch that the two had committed or were about to commit a burglary. I don't know. It seems to me that wearing heavy clothing and being a previously arrested burglar gives rise to an inference that's a bit more than a hunch. But he said it was a hunch. So he went back towards them, got out of the vehicle, and from about 7 yards away, he asked the woman what she and her companion were doing. She said they were coming from the Junction Cafe. The officer knew the cafe was in the opposite direction, so she had just lied to him. And it also had closed 2 hours earlier. When the officer asked the man to identify himself, he said he was Freddy. The officer then asked him to approach the cruiser. The man handed his duffel bag to the woman and stepped forward, raising the question of whether that was a submission to authority a la Hodari D. He then told him to bring the bag with him. The officer told the suspect to bring the bag with him. At that point, Freddie grabbed the bag and ran away, the officer chasing. As he entered the woods, Freddie threw the bag down. The officer retrieved it and found two bags of cocaine in it. The police later recovered information that led to the apprehension of Freddie. So this is a wonderful question of whether the submission to authority by stepping forward was an adequate submission of authority to constitute a seizure. So in this problem, the Connecticut court reversed the trial court and ordered the suppression of the evidence, but not because of an interpretation of Hodari D didn't apply, but because the state court decided not to apply Hodari D, but to apply instead the standards of Mendenhall or whatever. Holding that the Connecticut state constitution provides greater constitutional protection, the Mendenhall standard, whether a reasonable person would believe he was free to leave, governs under the state constitution. A reasonable person in the defendant's situation would not have felt free to leave because the officer was in a marked police cruiser. He drove past, blah, blah, blah. The court focused specifically on the time, the fact the officer was armed, and so on. So at the point in time when the officer said, come here, that was a sufficient show of authority, even without the guy stepping forward under Mendenhall, to constitute a seizure, and there was no sufficient grounds for the seizure at that point, and therefore, under the principles of Mendenhall and Terry, there was an unlawful seizure of the person, leading to the result that the evidence was obtained unlawfully. But that's under a higher state standard. Because under Hodari D, merely stepping forward and then escaping is probably not enough submission to authority to constitute a seizure. But it's certainly arguable both ways. It's a great problem. Okay? Any other questions? All right, let's take our break. We're making great progress.
I'm guessing you're a Bears fan?
Big time. Cubs, too.
Ooh, sorry.
Yeah. And Northwestern.
Sorry.
Huh?
Football